Welcome to the good old days. I'm Jerome Manigan. I have stories for you from the November 2006 issue of the good old days magazine. Starting today's program with a story by Mary Lou Ughley, A War Bride's View. World War II was at its height. We knew that John would be stationed somewhere, but we didn't know where. I had been born and raised in a small city on the East Coast. John came from a farm in a rural area. We met during the war because fate dictated that as a member of the ASTP program, he would be stationed at a local college. When I'm overseas, I want you to go to the farm and live with my parents, promise. I nodded, privately deciding that I would go as soon as possible. My mother will take good care of you and our baby, and I'll feel happy knowing that you are there. These words echoed in my head when we received the news that he would ship out any day. John and I had married in my church with a few friends in attendance. Our honeymoon took place during his final 10-day furlough before he went overseas. We had both known that this separation was coming, even before we decided to get married. I quit my job in the small hardware store and described our plans to my skeptical parents. Then I boarded the train to New York. I traveled on two more trains before I reached the farm. During my hours on the rumbling trains, I had time to muse over my future. I wondered what John's parents were like. Would they like me? Would there be a doctor nearby? My father-in-law met me at the small train station. He piled all my luggage in the back of his pickup truck, and then away we went. The skies were dark and threatening, and the cold seemed to penetrate my very bones. We arrived at the farmhouse almost an hour later, having spoken only a few words during the entire time. My mother-in-law greeted me warmly. The lights shone brightly, and there was a delicious dinner waiting on the blacktop stove. After a wonderful meal, I dragged myself upstairs to the room that was to be mine. It was chilly, but I covered myself with the gaily colored quilts and slept like a log. The next morning, the sun awakened me. I jumped out of bed, put on a house coat, and went down to breakfast. To my dismay, the family had been up and breakfasted hours earlier. I was made to understand that in the future, I was to be dressed when I came down for breakfast. Today, I could make my own. This was the first of many new experiences for me. One day, Dad took me out to the barn to show me the piglets that would grace the Thanksgiving table. He was so proud, but I was horrified. I gulped and smiled and tried not to remember how cute they had been when they came to the dinner table on plates with apples in their mouths. Before Christmas, we went out into the woods and chose our Christmas tree. It was a huge evergreen, beautifully shaped, and it took the men quite a while to cut it down and trim the excess boughs before pulling it up the road and setting it up in the living room. The wonderful scent permeated the entire house. My remembrances of the farm in winter are of pristine snow and lots of it on the evergreen trees. My, how they sparkled in the sun. Each day I walked down the long driveway to the RFD mailbox to get that daily letter from John. Then, for a month, I didn't hear a word from him. One of his boyhood friends had been killed in Italy, and we comforted the young widow as best we could. It was a difficult period. At last there came a letter and picture from John. On the bottom of the portrait were written the date and location of the drawing. We were so glad to know that John was alive. The Grange was an important part of my new family's life. Frequently, I was asked to go along with them to meetings and suppers, but Mother felt I shouldn't join because I'd have to parade around the hall, and it was quite obvious that I was pregnant. Under the Christmas tree that year, there was a maternity dress from the Sears catalog. Then I became a member. The Farm Extension Service was a branch of the Farm Bureau. They sent consultants to local groups to teach meal planning, health care, home decoration, and finances. Mother and I walked several miles to attend the all-day gatherings. It was a long hike, but I needed to lose some of the weight I had put on eating her wonderful homemade donuts. The women gave me a stork shower and reminisced about their own childbearing problems. I really had a lot to talk about with my mother-in-law on our long walk home. The winter days seemed endless. I sewed a layette for the baby, learned to knit, and learned to bake the biscuits that were served at every meal instead of bread. Their ingredients included fresh cream and buttermilk, which was saved from the weekly churning. Our old black stove needed lots of wood to keep it going at the right heat for baking. Dad and a hired man made sauerkraut during the winter, so we always had extra mouths to feed at noon. The hired man and his wife drove a long distance from their home to the farm in a horse-drawn sleigh. After some coaxing, they agreed to take me for a sleigh ride. Riding over the crisp snow with the horse shaking his head and ringing the sleigh bells was a special treat. During the week, Dad would take off one day and drive to the towns nearby to sell barrels of sauerkraut and fresh butter. I went along many times and listened to his conversations with the storekeepers. The regional accent was hard for me to understand sometimes, but everyone greeted Dad warmly and helped unload the barrels and other produce. We did a little shopping, had lunch, and then made sure that we had a special treat for Mother when we arrived home. John's grandmother was very old. I can still see her wrinkled face under her white hair as she played patience at the dining room table and cheated when she thought no one was in the room. Graham slept in a feather bed in the downstairs bedroom, and joy of joys, she had an indoor toilet in the anteroom there. She always wore a hat when she came to dinner. She was ready to go anywhere at any time. Sometimes she brought out the old musical instrument that her father had given her. It was shaped like a lap-sized player piano. She never let any of us forget that she had been a teacher and still heard from her pupils. Spring on the farm meant apple blossoms, calves, kittens, puppies, and babies. Graham was celebrating her 90th birthday with an open house on the farm. There were several angel food cakes to be made for the occasion, and I, being the designated baker, had a beaten good time. But then the baby decided it was time to arrive, and so that night Mother and Dad took me to the hospital in the next town. Spring was also mud season, when frozen dirt roads thawed into deep ruts and muddy puddles. It took twice as long to get anywhere, and you were wise to allow for the extra time. We arrived at the hospital parking lot a few minutes before midnight. We sat there until after the hour had struck so that we wouldn't have to pay for an extra day there. It was very warm for April. Gwen was a beautiful baby girl. I only wished that her father could see her. 10 days later, we returned to the farm. Then the weather changed drastically. The apple blossoms died, threatening the apple crop. All the crops seemed to shrivel and die. The children at the little schoolhouse had their annual picnic inside with a fire going. Everyone wore their winter clothes. I guess I was the local celebrity, and they asked me to sing a solo. It didn't sound very good to me, but they all seemed to enjoy it. In the hospital, I had become friendly with two other new mothers, and I visited them at their homes. We had our babies' pictures taken for the local newspaper photography contest. It didn't seem to us that the judges were fair. Our beautiful babies didn't win anything. I knew it was time for me to return to my home and family. Sadly, Mother and Dad helped us pack and took us to the same small railroad station where I had met Dad nearly a year ago. We finally said our goodbyes, and then the new family member and I started our long train ride home to show her to her other set of proud grandparents. I'll never forget the train conductor who heated the baby's bottle for me, or the baby basket that an uncle had made for Gwen's comfort on the train. My eyes have been opened to the simple values of these people and their love of the land. Maybe it was fate that had drawn me to John and his hard-working family. Now that John is retired and the children are married and away from home, we spend many months in the house on the side of the mountain, which we thoroughly enjoy. At least that's how this war bride sees it. A War Bride's View was written by Mary Lou Hughley. We're turning elsewhere in the Good Old Days magazine to Write Soon. It's by Ellen Fink. In 1955, when I was in the sixth grade, I became a letter-writing fanatic. I wrote to everyone from my grandmother in Milwaukee to my Aunt Bertha in Chicago. My obsession was fueled even further when I discovered the wonderful world of pen pals. At one point, I had 22 pen pals with addresses ranging from Boston to Hamburg, Germany. When my mother, who was in charge of our finances, complained about all the money she had to shell out for 3-cent stamps, my dad jumped to my rescue. "Just let her have her fun," he said. Sometimes I'd get as many as 5 letters in one day. I'd read all of them as soon as I got home from school and then immediately answer them. I'd always end each letter with "write soon." After I'd licked the envelope, I'd write SWAK on the flap, which was short for "sealed with a kiss." Some of the kids with whom I corresponded weren't long on words. Often I'd get a slip of paper with something like, "How are you? I am fine. My cat ran away. Love, Susie." A few letters, however, were newsy, and often as long as 3 pages. One girl I wrote to for years was fond of sending a stick of gum in her letters. Whatever my pen pals wrote didn't matter to me. Just getting a letter was enough. My father enjoyed mail time as much as I did. "You just never know what you'll get," he'd say as he leafed enthusiastically through seed catalogs, agricultural journals, and various advertisements. Dad didn't really care if he got a letter or not. He just loved getting mail, any kind of mail. Our farm was the last one on the mail route, so often it was the middle of the afternoon before we saw the car with the words "United States Mail" printed on its side. When my pen pal craze kicked into high gear, there'd be piles of mail every day, mostly addressed to me. Dad claimed the volume was growing too large for our mailbox. He started waking me half an hour earlier every day, figuring he'd kill 2 birds with 1 stone. I'd get my letters before I had to go to school, and he'd get to go through his catalogs and magazines early before returning to his work on the farm. When I reached the post office, the mailman still would be sorting the mail for the large route he drove Monday through Saturday. Often I'd wait for almost half an hour before he was finished. While I waited, I'd greet half the people in town as they walked up the 5 steps into the tiny post office to collect their mail from Don, the postman, who worked behind the window. My favorite person was the beautiful high school homecoming queen, who came in every morning with a letter she'd written to her boyfriend, who was stationed with the army over in Korea. Once in a while, one of my school friends would walk in, and we'd chat and giggle until Don would have to tell us to pipe down. When the hands on the clock inched their way toward 8, I'd begin to fidget, scared of being late for school. Sometimes the mailman would bring me the mail with minutes to spare. I'd rush to the car, where I'd barely have time to count my letters before Dad dropped me off. But I always made it on time before the bell rang. In September 1955, shocking news swept the country. President Eisenhower had suffered a heart attack. The folks in our little town gathered in the post office, grocery store, and barbershop, talking in hushed tones about our president's health. I decided to do what I did best. I set out to write the president a get-well letter. It took several days because I wanted it to be perfect. I wrote several drafts on notebook paper. Then, once I was satisfied, my mother gave me some of her best stationery and her favorite fountain pen. After going through half a box of stationery and a whole bottle of ink, I finally finished the letter. The next day, I hand-delivered it to Don, who never gave it a glance as he tossed it into the outgoing mail basket. Soon afterward, it was announced that the president would make a full recovery and would be recuperating at his home, the Little White House in Denver, Colorado. A few days before Thanksgiving, I was making my way up the post office steps when the mailman saw me. A big smile spread across his face. Instead of just handing me our mail with his usual short nod, he said, "Looks like you got something pretty important this morning." Looking down, I saw a parchment envelope with my name and address typed on the front, and in the upper left corner were the words, "The White House," stamped in green. I couldn't wait to show my dad. I carefully opened the envelope and pulled out a cream-colored card embossed with a gold eagle. Together, my dad and I read, "The President and I are deeply grateful for your expression of good wishes and prayerful concern. I assure you, your message has been helpful to him." It was signed by Mamie Dodd Eisenhower, the President's wife. For a while, I was a minor celebrity. I brought the letter to school so everyone could have a look. My picture and the letter's message were published in the newspaper. This went on for a few weeks. Then everyone forgot about it, and life went back to normal. Even after my list of pen pals dwindled, and I was no longer receiving so many letters, my dad and I still drove to town early every morning to get the mail. Although nothing quite as exciting as the letter from Mrs. Eisenhower ever arrived again, going to the post office was still my dad's and my favorite time of the day. It was like my dad said, "You just never know what you'll get." "Write Soon" was written by Ellen Fink. And we're turning elsewhere in the November 2006 issue of the Good Old Days magazine to this by Ken Tate, the editor and publisher of the Good Old Days magazine, looking back. "When I was a youngster growing up in the Ozark Mountains of southwest Missouri, school reunions were not the only ones held from year to year. Hometowns held them too. Whether they were called Old Home Days or Town Reunion or some other moniker, present and former neighbors gathered each year to renew old friendships and strengthen the bonds that made hometowns the backbone of any strong nation. Many families held their own reunions in conjunction with the town reunion. The whole festival seemed like Thanksgiving, Memorial Day, and the 4th of July all rolled into one. There was always a feeling of bittersweet in those reunions. Folks became mistily nostalgic when they walked the streets of their youth, remembering what they left behind. Yes, most left for the big city for more opportunities and better jobs, or any job in some instances. But it's hard to remember that when you embrace a friend you haven't seen since childhood. Perhaps it was that wonderful, ecstatic, poignant pain that led to the phrase, "You can't go home again." In all the years that my dear wife Janice and I have produced Good Old Days magazine, we have seen that you can go home again. You can nod to neighbors on the street and stop at those same shops again. You can watch a parade, share dinner on the grounds at your old church, and if you listen closely enough, you can almost hear Mama calling you at twilight to come inside for supper. Now, we're out to prove that memories of hometowns are not just something of the past. In 2007, we will launch Town Square, a new magazine devoted to the idea that hometowns are still the heartbeat of Americana. Town Square will focus on the character and characters that made and make small towns so important to our lives. Each issue will be packed with glimpses of main streets from all across America. Features and photographs will emphasize what was and still is the positive side of small town life. No, we can go home again. In fact, sometimes I think we must go home again, if just to remind us where our roots are and where we came from. Town Square will take you with us to those days again. The old home day stories will bring you smiles, laughter, and yes, some tears. But with every page, you will be reminded of what made each and every town square so special. Looking Back was written by Ken Tate, the editor and publisher of the Good Old Days magazine. And we're turning elsewhere in the Good Old Days magazine in the final days of today's program to That Saturday Afternoon. It's written by Ethel Wehunt. Ruth set the broom behind the kitchen door. "Are you about through?" she asked, peering at the laundry basket. "Looks like you have one more piece, one of those hard-to-iron white starch shirts Papa wore to jury duty." Passing through the kitchen, Mama said, "I'll do Papa's shirt." I gave a loud sigh of relief. I had not mastered the art of ironing starched shirts. I folded the tablecloth that had been my last piece from a basket full of Saturday ironing. Ruth said, "I have made the bed, swept upstairs and downstairs, dusted it all, and I'm through for this week. Let's go." Hearing that, Mama said, "There is stew on the back of the stove. Where are you going?" She was reaching into the cupboard for bowls, so we knew it was best that we ate before we left. "Riding," Ruth and I answered in unison. "Daddy left Dolly and Banjer in the lot for us." Mama dished up our stew. "You'll have to saddle up yourselves," she said. "Papa has gone to town." Ruth and I laughed merrily. "Mama, you know we can do that, if Dolly doesn't pull that swelling act on us," which she did. But by both of us pulling, we managed to get Dolly's girth tight enough so the saddle would not slip. Banjer was no problem. He was young and had not yet learned the tricks that Dolly had as an old, experienced children's pony. A mild wind blew a mist in our faces as we rode south. On reaching the 3/4-mile corner, Dolly decided that we had ridden far enough and decided to turn to go home. But with my coaxing and the encouragement of a tight rein and Banjo trotting in the lead, she changed her mind and continued on in a docile manner. Dolly was a pleasure to ride. She had a smooth gait, and if pressed into a gallop, she loped along with a long stride. I patted her neck, pulled her mane, and called her a good girl, enjoying the praise and attention. She moved even more smoothly. Ruth, jolting about on tall, lanky Banjo, said, "I get to ride Dolly when we come back." I didn't promise to switch mounts, but I did say, "Maybe if you will race me when I'm on Banjo." This cooled Ruth. She knew Banjer, with his long legs, can outrun short-winded Dolly. Dolly's past racing age, I agree. She is old and worn out, and besides, she won't run unless she wants to. We jogged on down the ungraded dirt road. As we passed the Johnson place, we waved at Bud and Ed, who were grinding feed down by their barn. "Do you suppose they'll follow us?" Ruth asked. "Who?" I replied. We continued riding slowly. We had crossed the crooked bridge and passed the Conway farm when we heard hoofbeats. Ruth was delighted, but she said, "Don't act surprised. The Johnson boys, Bud and Ed, whoaed up beside us." "Where you going?" Bud asked. "Nowhere," Ruth answered nonchalantly. "Where are you going?" Ed was bolder than Bud. He said, "Girls, we are riding with you. We aim to teach you the evil habit of cigarette smoking." From his jumper pocket, he took a can of Prince Albert tobacco and a packet of cigarette papers. "See," he said, as he began to demonstrate the art of rolling a cigarette. "Let's get out of the middle of the road with this lesson," Bud suggested, but we rode on. Like the good girl she was, Dolly ignored the Johnson horses, but Banjo showed some animosity, and Ruth, who was having trouble keeping him in line. He plunged and danced about, baring his teeth and threatening the strange horses before finally settling down to a rough, jolting trot. "Let me have that scoundrel," Ruth Ed said. "You take mine. Daisy is gentle." They traded mounts, and when Banjo felt a strong hand on his rein, he calmed to a walk. The boys rolled cigarettes and lit them for Ruth and me. Ruth said, "This is fun, isn't it, Ethel?" I nodded yes, as I blew smoke into the cool, misty air. Bud stared anxiously at the two of us smoking like old smokers. "Are you dizzy?" he said. But we weren't doing half so well as it seemed. "Give me my horse," Ruth said. "I have to go home." I wondered if my face was as pale as hers was, if her head was too big, if the whole world was going round and round. "We have to go," I said. "Mama is expecting us." "Papa will be home," Ruth added. "He will wonder about us." Amazed and puzzled, Ed and Bud said, "We want to ride with you. Whatever is wrong?" Finally, honest Ruth exclaimed, "We are sick. We can't smoke." The boys laughed uproariously. "We'll see you home," Bud said. And being good sports, they rode with us to our door, unsaddled Dolly and Banjo, put them in their stalls, and fed them oats and hay. Then, still laughing, they rode away, declaring no smoking on our next ride. So there we were, with Mama yet to face. We tried to walk from the barn in a normal manner, but I fear that we staggered a bit, well, a lot. Mama was in the garden, covering tomato vines. The mist from the south had changed to sleet from the north. Ruth said, "If we get some more stew and act natural, Mama is so busy covering plants, she won't notice us." When Mama came in, Ruth and I were sitting at the table, stew before us. Now, Mama was kind, gracious, and thoughtful, and smart. All she said was, "I believe the Johnson boys were smoking." That lesson on that day was the sum total of my smoking career. Ruth vowed, "I will never smoke again," and also ended her association with tobacco. That Saturday afternoon was written by Ethel Wehunt. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information by Robin Clemens.